will say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for, if not for shedding? With my hook for a hand, I'll split you from your groin to your gullet. I came for you.
Welcome to Now Playing's Candyman movie review series.
The urban legend is, if you say his name five times while looking in the mirror, he appears in the reflection and kills you.
Hosted by Arnie.
You like hanging out with this Latin lover because he's dangerous?
Stuart.
He's the monster that's part of this neighborhood.
And Jacob.
You are not content with the stories, so I was obliged to come.
This podcast may contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
These stories are modern oral folklore.
Listener discretion is advised.
Now I must shed innocent blood. Come with me.
Be my victim.
Today, we're discussing Candyman, starring Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, Teyonah Parris, Nathan Stewart Jarrett, Coleman Domingo, Vanessa Williams.
Still not the one you're thinking of.
Tony Todd, directed by Nia DaCosta. Say my name!
Arnie?
Yes, co-host of Now Playing. And Moscato is not just a dessert wine.
And this is Stewart.
And this is the co-host everyone's a buzz about, Jacob.
I see what you did.
The movie did it. Like, multiple times.
Yeah, they swarmed us with those comments. Well, welcome back, silver donors, honey donors, sweets for the sweet donors, all of you who donated for Candyman reviews. Thank you for your patience. Not that we had a lot of choice in the matter, but we are happy to finally be bringing you the review of what was pretty much called Jordan Peele's Candyman in the early days. He co-wrote it. He produced it. He was going to direct it early on, but Nia DaCosta came in.
Yeah, I was been waiting all of this time with some anticipation. Jordan Peele is a draw for me. Jordan Peele is not the director. The director of this movie is Nia DaCosta, who is relatively unknown. I did go back and dig up her original film just to try and get a flavor, a sense of what she is trying to accomplish. And it is not at all horror. It's not even really a thriller. It feels like a drama about women in dire straits.
Yeah, you're talking about Little Woods, which from the trailer looks like some kind of drug heist film, but the actual movie is about the American healthcare system. More or less, like,
it feels very connected to movies like Winter's Bone, you know, like women in very dire straits having to do things like, yeah, go find a bag full of Oxycontin or go have an abortion. And it means crossing the Canada-US border to do so. It's character driven. It is about giving the screen fully to the performers. It's Tessa Thompson. It's pretty good. There's nothing about it that I found exceptional, but for a debut film, it was very competent. It accomplished what it set out to do. And you would definitely take a meeting with her and see what else she had in mind. And if she had a great pitch for a Candyman movie, by all means, let's see what they can do together, for sure. I've enjoyed both of his films. I think he has a really good, unique take on horror. And I know he's not the director, but knowing it was coming from his fingerprints, that he, you know, Oscar-winning Jordan Peele was going to co-write this script and, yeah, cultivate new talent that's obviously he feels is worthy of the cause, I was super hyped for this. This has to be the longest we've ever had to wait for the end of a series. I know Jupiter Ascending kept us like maybe 6 months on hold, but yeah, a year and a half. I'm so glad we're finally here talking Candyman.
Yeah, we had to wait a long time to see this, to review this. It's been a long time since the last Candyman film. I mean, there were a lot of plans to bring Candyman back. I mean, we could have already had a fourth installment because after Freddy vs. Jason, they were hot. Candyman versus Leprechaun. It was in development.
That's not a fair fight.
Yeah, we all lose no matter who wins, Alien versus Predator.
I mean, Tony Todd versus Warwick Davis, come on. I want them playing basketball. That's what I want. Candyman versus Leprechaun.
For Leprechaun, that is, you know, trading up. But I feel like for this franchise, that would be turning it into a joke. That's going in the wrong direction.
Tony Todd said he will never be involved in that. So it was Tony Todd clinging to some integrity of the character that you'd think would be lost by that third movie.
Did he want to be involved in this one? Because we'll get there, but that was part of the mystery and part of the fun for this one is from the trailers, they looked really good, but I didn't know if this was a reboot, a sequel. I didn't know what we were going to get, but I never did see Tony Todd in any of those trailers. I didn't know if he was going to show up.
That was spoiled for me. You know, back when they started this, Tony Todd was like, I love Jordan Peele. I think that Candyman's in good hands. I'd love to be involved, but this is Hollywood, and if they don't call me, no hard feelings, good luck to the next person. But I think it came out, even before the movie was supposed to come out in early 2020, that Tony Todd was in it. I didn't know if he was going to be the Candyman, or if he was just going to have a cameo, and this was going to pass the baton.
I think you got both of those parts right, from what I saw.
Yeah, my understanding coming into this was the one thing that I had heard was that baby Anthony had been all grown up, and he was going to turn into Candyman.
Oh, so you knew that too, going in. See, all this stuff was surprises to me.
Okay, no, I was not disappointed by that, because that's essentially this movie, very much. Tony Todd, I heard he was not Candyman. I had heard that they were going with Yahya Abdul-Mateen as Candyman.
Yeah, they had first announced that Yahya was going to be Candyman, and then they tried to backtrack from that. No, he's going to be Anthony, but I didn't know he was baby Anthony.
Yeah.
So when I went in, I knew Candyman was in this. Opening credits told me Vanessa Williams was going to be in this. I felt so clever and was patting myself on the back halfway through the movie. I'm like, they keep talking about his mother. His mother's going to be Vanessa Williams. He's the baby!
Yeah.
I thought I was really smart.
It's a shocker. I'm just going to put it out there. If you haven't seen the original film, if you're just coming in because you like Get Out and Us and, okay, let's see what Jordan Peele has as well, you know, the next project, it is all explained to you. But I was shocked at how much this is going to stay rooted in the original film, that this is really a sequel, direct.
Isn't this also kind of a reboot of Part 3? Wasn't that all about art galleries and paintings?
Yes, they're picking up on the fact that, lest we forget, Daniel Robitaille was a painter, and that was what got him in trouble, was that he was painting some white woman and fell in love, and they want to pick up on that aspect of Candyman. But again, so many aspects of the Bernard Rose movie are brought back here. You would think that Bernard Rose had directed this film. It feels of the same piece.
He wanted to direct a sequel. He had a project in the aughts. He wanted $25 million to do it, and it was going to be a prequel, and they said no, but they ended up spending $25 million on this one, so.
$25 million isn't as much today as it was in the 90s.
No, that's low budget. That's, yeah.
This one, though, they're just doing the Halloween thing, right? The name is Candyman, the same way the last Halloween was called Halloween. It's a direct sequel to the first one. Not that Candyman rules out the second or third films from happening.
Yeah, all that stuff could have still happened in Nolan's.
Yeah, but this one isn't going to talk about those movies.
But there is a huge difference there. Like, Halloween, John Carpenter is a classic, bona fide, capital C. If you're into horror, you've seen that movie, everyone must. Candyman was always an obscurity. I feel like its highest grosser is like 30 million, you know, like it just never achieved a whiff of what Michael Myers had done. So the expectation that audiences would remember 30 years later, almost key details from the original movie, that's banking on a lot.
We're going to get a lot of shadow puppets. They're going to replay that movie like three different times with shadow puppets. And I feel like Candyman, maybe it's not John Carpenter's Halloween, but it's definitely like B-tier horror. Like, even me, who wasn't big into horror as a teen, I knew what Candyman was.
I think it's become more of a cult one. You know, it's not underground and it's not completely unknown B-trash like witchcraft or warlock, but I think it's probably had a much greater life in video. And the fact that it is Bernard Rose's original, a bit of a smarter horror film, a bit more socially conscious horror film, it feels like it's more respectable than a lot of other horror films out there. Like
Leprechaun.
Yeah, it could go to the fancy table, even if it doesn't have as much money as some of these others. But I agree with you. I was shocked how much this would rely on the first one. I didn't plan on it, but I did rewatch the first Candyman before seeing this. I just had some extra time and decided to rewatch the first one. With all the shadow puppets, like you said, Jacob, I don't know that I had to. I know that movie pretty well, and what little I forgot, it would have told me.
The one thing I didn't remember that received shadow puppets is Helen doing Snow Angels in Blood. Did that happen in the original Candyman? I don't remember that scene.
No.
The story that's told in the beginning is not the way that it happened in the movie. So there are liberties taken, as there are with all urban myths, with the truth. I mean, she was in a pool of blood. There was a Rottweiler head, but not exactly as the campfire tale would describe it.
Yeah, it's amazing how much this movie will play on the urban legend topic of the first film without ever bringing up the fact that it is continuing that way of looking at things and the way stories are shaped by cultures and passed down through oral tradition and get misreported sometimes.
Arnie, why don't you give him the plot and we'll find out.
Chicago artist Anthony McCoy was once the hot new thing on the block, but even help from his live-in girlfriend and art gallery director Brianna Cartwright can't fix his lack of inspiration. When Brianna's brother Troy tells the story of Helen Lyle, who you may remember was Virginia Madsen's character from the first film, where she was investigating Cabrini Green for the Candyman, went insane, and kidnapped a baby to burn in a fire, the story gives Anthony his spark. He wants to find out more about Cabrini and use his art to discuss white gentrification of poor black neighborhoods. He goes to Cabrini, where his hand gets stung by a bee. He also meets laundromat owner William Burke, a man who grew up in Cabrini Green in the 70s. Burke tells Anthony the story of the Candyman, specifically a man named Sherman Fields. The man had a hook for a hand, but was friendly, giving candy to the kids of Cabrini. When some candy is found with razor blades in it, Sherman disappears. After that, Sherman came to give young William some candy, but William got scared and screamed. Cops rushed the building and killed Sherman, but later it was found out Sherman was not the one who put the razors in the candy. Now legend says if you say Candyman five times into a mirror, Sherman will appear and kill you. Anthony uses this story to create an art piece that resembles a mirror called Say My Name, but art critic Finley Stevens calls it trite and generally awful. But after the show, the gallery owner and his young lover say Candyman in front of the reflective painting and are slaughtered by the ghost of Sherman. Others are also inspired to say Candyman and are killed. The reporters call these the Say My Name killings. Anthony is enjoying the notice his art is getting, being attached to the murders and all, but his hand got infected from the bee sting and it's spreading up his arm. He goes to a Cabrini Green area hospital to have it looked at, and the doctor tells him he was born at that hospital. Anthony goes to talk to his mother Anne Marie, Vanessa Williams reprising her role from the first film. She reveals Anthony was the baby that was kidnapped in that first movie, but Helen saved him from Candyman Daniel Robitaille. She lied to Anthony about his youth so he'd never be associated with Cabrini Green. Anthony goes back to Cabrini, where he's taken by William Burke. After Burke saw police kill Sherman Fields, Burke's sister was killed by the spirit of Sherman when she played the Candyman game. Burke says there's a line of Candymen, the first of whom was Daniel Robitaille. Now, Burke wants Anthony to be the next Candyman.
This sounds like a reality show, doesn't it?
Who will be the next Candyman?
Yeah, I have a lollipop that I'm going to give somebody, and yeah, who will it be?
We're out in Chicago this weekend, auditioning potential Candymen. Like, yeah, they go around the country. Ryan Seacrest is there. Mm. Yeah.
Sorry, dog, you just don't have enough of a hook.
That works two ways.
He cuts off Anthony's diseased hand and replaces it with a hook. Brianna comes looking for Anthony and is kidnapped by Burke. Fighting to escape, she stabs Burke to death. Anthony collapses. The cops arrive, and seeing Burke stabbed to death, they shoot and kill Anthony, even though Anthony is just laying down on the ground. The cops arrest Brianna and tell her she can either say the cops killed Anthony in self-defense, or the cops will say Brianna was Anthony's accomplice and she'll go to jail. Instead, she says Candyman five times into the rearview mirror, and Anthony's spirit appears as Candyman and slaughters the cops. But the final cop that's killed isn't by Anthony, but by Daniel Robitaille. He tells Brianna to tell everyone as credits roll. A lot to unpack there.
Indeed, yeah. I've got lots of questions. And unfortunately, I only did get one opportunity to see this movie Thursday opening night. I really do wish I had had one more viewing of this.
I did see it twice. I went, listen, my area is being ravaged with COVID. I know not all of our listeners think that's a problem, but I do think it's a problem as I have a 101-year-old who lives with me. I can't bear to carry anything, so I had trouble finding a showing of this. Most showings were really full, so I finally got to see it Sunday morning, and after seeing it, I was like, crap. So I watched it again. So I have seen it twice for this review.
Good. You can answer all our questions. Okay. I agree, Stuart. I have a lot of questions, especially about this ending.
I don't think it helped me. I've got to be honest. And all it did was get me a nice bag of popcorn refilled, because I don't know that it really helped a lot. So don't feel so bad, Stuart. And another reason why I wanted to see it twice, I thought my projector was fucking broken when I went to see this movie. I'd finally found a showing, just, you know, it's about 8 hours before recording this, 9 hours. And I'm sitting in the theater, I watch the trailers, and then comes up the MGM logo, and the damn thing's backwards, and I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, the Universal logo's backwards, the Monkey Paw production. I'm right there with you, Arnie. Like, I'm at a drive-in. Like, who knows what their quality control is? They could have just...
Hang the projectionist.
Well, there's no film to put in there, but I don't know. Maybe they're running a bootleg file.
Somehow It's the millennial in the booth's fault.
Like, I was turning around because I could see the other drive-in screens. If, like, I turned around, I'm like, no, theirs aren't backwards. What's going on?
I had the same thing. I'm like... If these assholes, I know there's no film, but God knows I've seen enough movies where they screwed up the 3D projection, and I'm sitting there like, if this entire movie has its text backwards, how much is that going to hurt the movie for me?
Yeah, thank goodness Cabrini-Green 1977 finally shows up, because I knew, okay, that's the right way, it's not a screw-up, it's intentional mirrors. I remember lots of mirrors with Candyman, so okay.
Also, the reason why you know that this is playing as it should is that we are hearing the Candyman that I know, Sammy Davis Jr.,
yes.
Singing his classic recording. It actually does kind of go funny towards the end, but if they were projecting it backwards, something tells me we wouldn't be able to have the audio quality we do have at the beginning. But I agree, it's a grabber, and it immediately has me excited for going back in time to the 70s. This is, historically speaking, way after Daniel Robitaille, Tony Todd, but way before Virginia Madsen ever started her grad student thesis.
Yeah, because the original Daniel Robitaille, yeah, he was 100 years before this, but Virginia Madsen, she was the 90s, and here, yeah, we're in the 70s. There's a lot of Afro puffs going around.
Little William. I was like, have we met this character? Again, I thought I knew that Anthony was coming back. I thought maybe this was baby Anthony, but I'm like, no, that timeline doesn't match up. William is a new character.
And we see him before he has to go do the laundry. You know, we talked a lot about these shadow puppets. It was a big part of the advertising, a big part of the trailers before this came out. And I was interested to see how that all was going to get incorporated. I guess William here as a kid, like, he did those shadow puppets. We'll see him doing that before his mom tells him to do the laundry. And it just makes me wonder, like, that is the best art we'll see in this film? Like, is he a frustrated artist? Is this all a revenge plot to get back at these artists? Because he's the best artist in this film if he's doing all these shadow puppets.
Not only that, but he is the puppet master. He is the one in control. We will find out that all things that happen really are because William grew up with the idea that he wanted Candyman coming back.
But the puppet show is a cop chasing a black man. And then I'm going to find out we're in the 70s. I'm like, okay, William was ahead of his time by a good 40 years. That's everything in the conversation today about race. You know, George Floyd and Et Al. There's so many of them. George Floyd is one of the names. Breonna Taylor, so many. But Here he's discussing it back then, and I'm not saying this is a new phenomenon.
Yeah, I think that cops were a problem for black communities in 1977. We can see, at the very least, they're not going to help him with his laundry problem. He's got to carry his big basket of socks and t-shirts all the way across.
He dropped a sock. That sock's going to be lost forever now. No match for it.
Yeah, they could have told him, but they've just let him go on.
I thought they were going to arrest him for littering. That's what I thought they were talking about, is like, kid dropped a sock. Are we going to get him? Nah, let him go.
No, they are asking people, have you seen this man? And you get the sense early on that there is unrest in this neighborhood. We see Little William walking from the row houses, which Cabrini Green is remembered for the tower, which has been taken down. But the row houses did remain. They're two-story in rows of communities that I guess their laundry facilities are in the basement of the towers. He's got to walk all the way over there. And his sister is standing outside and says, I hope Sherman gets you, which, again, creates the idea that there's someone in the neighborhood, a Sherman that is on the loose. And with the way that this movie is being set up, I believe we're seeing the first kill. I didn't realize William would come back in the future. I thought we were going to see a Candyman victim. Certainly when he gets to the laundry room and he's all alone and there's that lights on a timer ticking away, it's a real suspenseful moment.
See, and I thought we were seeing our main character as a child. I didn't think that the first death was going to be a teen or preteen black male.
But he's not named Anthony. I mean, that stuck out to me. They made a point of calling him Billy.
Right, but I didn't know Anthony was going to be the main character when I'm watching this scene the first time. So I thought our main character was going to be William, and we were seeing an encounter that William had as a child, and that would impact William in the present day.
We hear William scream. We don't see him. You see Sherman walk out of that hole. We hear a scream. The cops get out of the car, run towards the building, and then we cut to 2019 Cabrini Green. So I'm like, okay, that was just our teaser to pull us in, to show us Candyman is dangerous. So yeah, I never thought we'd see William again.
Right, an origin. I mean, I remember there definitely, it was up on one of the higher levels, but there was the secret room behind a mirror that Candyman, some version of Candyman, maybe it was only a drug dealer, but somebody that put razor blades in wrapped candy was in a secret room in Cabrini. I thought, again, this is origin story. This is where he started, in the basement, and I guess he moved up to the 10th floor later.
Well, it's a little bit different. I mean, we did meet a drug dealer known as the Candyman who carried a hook in that first movie, in addition to Daniel Robitaille, but there wasn't any razor blade candy from that guy. The only candy he was giving you was a rock you smoke.
Well, in the room it was there.
Oh, yeah, there was some in the room. But yeah, I thought this was going to be our main character. I really did. And we see him, see this guy come out of a hole in the wall with a hook hand. And it's not Tony Todd.
Nope.
So I didn't know who the hell this guy was. He's got a long coat, the hook hand, accoutrements of a Candyman, but not Tony Todd. I didn't know exactly how he'd play in. Is he human? Is he ghost? What is this coming through the wall?
My mistake was that I believe that they were restarting this, that this was not a sequel. And so I was not expecting to see a Candyman I had seen before. I thought if Tony Todd was in this, they'd give him some dumb cameo in a candy store as the, you know, guy that hands out the milk duds or something. I didn't think he would be getting the bees on him again.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Stuart, because I didn't know, besides what I saw in the trailers, I didn't know if Tony Todd was coming back. I didn't know if this was a reboot, a sequel, whatnot. So from this opening, I'm like, okay, so they're just restarting this. This isn't about Tony Todd's character from the 1800s that fell in love with a white girl. Like, they're doing something new, and I'm totally fine with that. I'm going with it.
Correct. But then we're going to jump ahead. We don't see what happens. We jump ahead to 2019, not 2021. By the point this movie was supposed to come out, this still would have been a year in the past to make us feel we're seeing, like, the recent news type headline thing.
I mean, they are correct. Cabrini has changed to a gentrified neighborhood. I dare say that up-and-coming artists could afford to live there. I mean, just by judging the skyscrapers and the high-rises and the things that are there, you would have to have a whole lot of money to be living in that environment. Certainly pre-pandemic.
it's a good thing Anthony's girlfriend's a curator, I guess, because he's a struggling artist, and there's no way a struggling artist could afford this place. This place is too nice.
Yeah, later they're going to have a debate, which I think is absolutely true, that poor neighborhoods get re-evaluated when artists come in and prettify everything around them.
Yeah, it's those hipster artists that gentrify these areas at first. I did like that point.
That is the story of so many urban revitalizations. But here, they're lucky to be in such an environment, because I think you would have to have millions and millions.
Yeah, they're having conversations about which wine to have, dessert wines, all the like. I can't even keep up with all this.
The only wine I can drink is Moscato, and they seem to be making fun of people who drink Moscato. Fuck that movie.
Well, my wife did turn to me before they even called it out. She's like, that's a dessert wine.
Ooh.
Not everyone is making fun of the wine. Troy is making fun of the wine. That we have a lot of characters being thrown at us. And usually you want to establish who is our main character. The person we see first is Troy. He is sort of the comic relief, the wine snob bringing his white boyfriend to meet his sister. It may take you a little while to realize that the sister's boyfriend is who we are supposed to be paying attention to.
It did. I was very confused. I'm following Troy around. I'm like, oh, okay.
My first thought was that we would have a gay protagonist, and I did think that was progressive. My second thought, and remember, I'd rewatched Candyman, is that this was going to be the Ted Raimi of the film. I thought these would be our opening kills. Like, the gay couple would say Candyman and be killed.
Yeah, I definitely felt like they would have had an arc that would have brought them into contact with Candyman. They're really here only to establish that the urban myth that is still being told about this neighborhood is involving Helen. It's the white woman that people remember. It's not Candyman at all. Which kind of was what we were saying at the end of the first film. That bonfire was almost like the community saying, let us never speak of this again. We are getting rid of our boogeyman. But again, I didn't know whether they were really tying back to that or not. So it was weird that they brought up Helen Lyle. And it made me wonder, it was the first point of the movie where I realized, maybe this is a sequel.
Oh, yeah. At this point, I'm like, oh, okay, they're doing a direct sequel. I mean, they're referencing Helen. This must be in the same continuity.
Yeah, they have a whole shadow puppet. Like, you forget she cut the head off a Rottweiler, but she did do that.
Candyman did that. If you're to take the movie at face value, she cut the head off the Rottweiler. If you go with the she's insane interpretation of that movie, the shadow puppets. Nia DaCosta talked about this. She and Jordan Peele did not want to just do old footage. They just didn't want to do the standard flashbacks. Here's scenes from the last film. So that's the real reason we have these shadow puppets the whole time.
They're stylistic. I do question, like, they keep going back to them. Like, what's the point of this? We saw, again, a young William doing this when he was a kid. So it made me question, like, why are they going to this motif? But it's a very cool looking way to go about giving us this data dump information of the past.
And I wanted to just say, in general, this is a really good-looking movie, like, stylistically. Oh, yeah. Like, I feel like I'm in good hands here.
Yeah, when we're going over Cabrini Green, what it's become, like, they turn the camera upside down or whatever. Look, you know, we talk about mirror images and all that, and it feels like the clouds are on the ground. And, yeah, they do a lot of neat tricks like that.
I'm just torn between if the shadow puppets are too much, but I go with it in the end, you know? It's right there on the borderline of acceptability. I mean, if this were animated, would I go with it? You know, but it's kind of a cool style. I've not seen it done before. And it is probably better because if this is a short movie at 90 minutes, and if all of these times they use shadow puppets, they actually used old footage of the movie, I think you'd have to put co-directed by Bernard Rose on this.
Keep in mind, too, Troy is telling a different version than what is known to the fans and the movie audiences. At no point does he know anything about Candyman. He's telling a spooky story about crazy Helen Lyle, who tried to kill a baby, who in his version, like, she walks into the fire after she fails to murder a stolen child from Cabrini Green. And we know that's not what happened at all.
Yeah, and in the back of my mind, because again, I don't know exactly where this film is going to go, but one of my frustrations, I think, with especially the original, because those sequels, whatever, but why is this about a black victim of white racism, and then he turns against black people? Like, shouldn't he be going after white people? So it's interesting seeing this at the beginning here, where this myth about, again, this horrific past, it's been literally whitewashed. It's all about a white woman now. So, again, I think they're doing some interesting things here. They paid attention to that original film. I think they're doing some very subtle and smart things with the way they're retelling these myths and how they've changed because of race.
But keep in mind, at the end of that first movie, when the very end stinger is Helen coming to kill her cheating husband with a hook, we're supposed to think she did supplant the Candyman legend at the end of that movie. So this is really hewing much truer to the end of part one than either of the earlier sequels did.
Right. And Jacob, you mentioned part three and the art gallery stuff. That is really cool here. I'm surprised at how informed the director and the screenwriters feel about the art scene in Chicago. I know a little bit about it because I did go to art school and I did go to a lot of gallery shows and just knew people that were visual medium artists. And I feel like, wow, this is pretty unique in a slasher movie scenario to see people that are upwardly mobile, not teenagers, and really consumed with art. Like, is a very different setup than I would have imagined them telling the story about a slasher in the projects.
And like we called out earlier, I think it's appropriate in a story about gentrification because that's a little dirty little secret of gentrification. It is often artists that, like, they call out in this film. They go to these areas that have cheap rent so they can just work in their studios all day without real jobs. And then that, you know, as those white artists move in, like, it goes the way it goes. And so I thought this was really smart in how it was addressing those themes of gentrification that first one was addressing as well.
But unlike that third movie, I feel like these actors are very likable, and it's this, again, authenticity is the word I kept going to. This feels real and compelling, and I really feel sucked into a very particular time and place.
Is part of that authenticity not understanding any of the conversations like these critics are having? That's why I feel like I need to watch this a second time, because I'm like, are they just saying artistic mumbo-jumbo, or like they making real points? It was hard to follow with one viewing.
Yeah, there's a lot of pretension. I do feel that there are a lot of people that speak about their work in ways that normal human beings don't talk.
To me, real artists and art critics talking about this is the exact same mumbo jumbo. Seeing it twice, there's exact specifics just run over me, and I'm getting the tone of the conversation. I'm getting their basics of what they're saying in relation to how the characters are reacting to art. At the very beginning here, we're seeing that the gallery owner is very upset and going to replace Anthony at an art showing because he just, I guess the hands around the noose are just yesterday's news.
That's so 2 years ago, yeah. Anthony is looking for inspiration. I do tend to agree with that critic. Like, that's easy stuff. Like, showing a black guy with a nude, like, that's an easy response. Like, dig deeper.
Well, this is not a critic. This is a man that makes money on selling the art. And he's named Clive. I have to believe that's a reference to Barker. He is wanting this artist to dig. Well, you know, what does he want to do? You could read this a couple different ways. Maybe he wants him to do work that's less superficial, or maybe he just feels like black artists need to talk about the ghetto, because he's really not interested in what this man currently wants to say, although maybe it is not totally fresh. He wants him to talk about housing projects. And when Cabrini Green gets mentioned as the subject matter for something he wants to work on next, that's what's going to be in the show. That's how they want to represent this black artist.
Yeah, because he talks about his childhood in a different area of Chicago and the
Bronzeville, which is also went through a transformation. It was sort of a housing project area and has really come up, but not unlike Cabrini.
But doesn't have the name recognition of Cabrini. And you can tell the gallery owner is not interested in Bronzeville. He wants Cabrini. And so Anthony's going to go with a camera, much like Helen did back in that first movie, start taking pictures around. It's a very different Cabrini, as you talked about, Stuart. And
yet there are still things there. Like, I like the fact that he printed things off the internet. He's looking at the picture of the church, pulls it down. Somehow that has survived. Somehow the row houses are still there. The tower is gone. It's basically a flattened field. But Yeah, largely the ghost of what the neighborhood used to be is still in evidence. There still could be a Candyman lurking around. And I thought, again, this is a really cool environment for a horror movie. An artist seeking the remnants of the setting of the last, or rather the original movie.
But bees. I always associate bees with Candyman. You know, they slathered Daniel Robitaille with honey and let the bees eat him. When he'd open that coat, the bees would come out. And as soon as Anthony is in Cabrini, there's a bee and is going to sting him on his hand. And then, you know, if a bee stings you, it's a female, usually leaves the stinger in you, it's going to die. This one dies instantly and the ants come to eat it.
Yeah, we have to believe it's supernatural, right? That there is a point to this bee being attracted to this man. We'll find out that he has a history connected with this Cabrini Green neighborhood, and that this is Candyman. This is the ghost of Candyman in bee form, starting him on the path of becoming my replacement, the 21st century take on the character.
And did you guys predict, because when that happened, I'm like, oh, that's going to be his hook hand. Like, that's going to get infected or something.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I thought it was pretty obvious where it was going.
Yeah, I don't think they try to disguise that. I think that that's a knowing audience that did see the original movie would know exactly what's happening to Anthony.
Yeah, I came into this fairly blank other than the Tony Todd thing. But once I see this, I realize what we're having here is, what do they call it, a legaquil or a legacy sequel, where we're going to retell the first movie, but also say we're a sequel to the first movie, the way Jurassic World did. Here, what we've got is the first movie was the story of Helen investigating the Candyman and then becoming the Candyman. And so now we're going to do it perhaps a little bit more close to how it was. We're going to have a black man investigating the Candyman and becoming the Candyman. I figured that out here. I didn't think it would get infected or anything. I didn't see the Brendelfly transition coming that happens, but I did think this was marking his hand.
And when he goes into one of the row houses to take pictures of the graffiti, like Helen does, what he sees on the wall is not Candyman, but I think a white cop, right? What is being remembered by this neighborhood is the white aggression. And there seems to be nowhere, anywhere, a representation of the urban myth that was so common in the early 90s. The thing that, you know, Helen kept running into everywhere she went is on the lips of all the residents. No one here knows anything about Candyman, except one dude who he just happens to bump into.
Yeah, okay. Artie, you saw this twice, and we talked about William being the puppet master behind the scenes. He's going to end up having a big deal, but is there, like, is he already in league with Candyman? Like, why does he know to hang around here? Because it looks like the Rose, as we're calling them, I guess, they're gated up. We saw Anthony had to climb a gate and then hide from a cop who was driving by, and that's when William pops out. Like, has he just been waiting here, waiting for someone to take on the Candyman role?
I think he still lives there.
I thought he lived in the area and was cutting to work, because if you look behind him at that, there's just an open sidewalk and a gate that's just wide open. So
Anthony didn't have to jump a gate. He could have just walked a block around it.
Yeah. I did find it funny that at the beginning of the movie, we see William being sent to do laundry, and that has influenced his life to such a degree he now owns a laundromat.
Well, that's how I knew it was William from the opening scene, is like, oh, he's running a laundromat. There's got to be that kid growing up now.
Well, I think my take on this is he never left. That kid stayed in that house. Most of the other people have been shuttled off.
But these houses are closed down, right? Like, they're abandoned. That's how they looked.
Yes, they do look like that, but we only see the inside of one row house. And so it's clear some of them have been defaced and vandalized. But my sense is that if you were to go to the one that little William was coming out of with his laundry, he has never wanted to leave behind. And we will find out later that Candyman came and killed his sister. So there is a long-standing connection to him and the real fantastical slasher Candyman, not just the Sherman Fields that he runs into in the basement of the laundromat. See, the reason why I think he's running a laundromat now is because the towers were demoed. And so somebody's got to serve that community. That was where the laundry was done. And now that the tower's gone, well, he's going to be the one to keep it alive.
Yeah, there's definitely a feeling that he's the one keeping the legend alive. Harbinger or whatnot, it feels a little awkward the way he's just appears in this.
It does. Everything about this character is the worst thing of this movie.
I love Colman Domingo. Really?
The character...
The actor? Sure, I don't have anything against this actor, yeah. But this role, I don't understand this character.
Yes. This character has no motivation, explanation. He's the reason I saw it twice. This character and his actions are vital to the entire machinations of this movie and are completely unmotivated.
Yeah, I do want to walk through it. I'm hearing you guys saying you don't find it satisfying.
I don't find it comprehensible.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to understand it.
I'm hoping to find an answer in here. Let's see what we can find here. My take is, again, that he was a kid that was, while everyone else moved away or was killed by Candyman, he, for some reason, won't let it go. He remains and tries to continue to keep what he knew happened here alive. As the story has moved on to white women and white cops and no one talking about Candyman.
Yeah, and we get the second of flashback stories. But this one is shown in film because it's new footage. It's not shadow puppets, but we get to see what happened after that prologue. Little William saw Sherman, and Sherman gave him candy, no razors in it, and the kid was scared. Kid screamed. The cops came. Sherman knew what was going to happen and is a kind man. He's like, well, I guess I'm going to be arrested now for things I didn't do, but you're still a nice kid here, still have some candy. And William now knows what he has caused, and he just stands there stunned as more police than we ever saw were in the area just storm the place and kill Sherman.
Yeah, the sound design makes it seem like they're the swarm. They sound, when we hear them running up above this basement laundromat, like they sound like this buzzing hive of something. They've suddenly become cast as the villain. And yes, this poor kid has incredible guilt about the fact that, okay, the rumor was he was going around giving razor blades and candy. But in truth, I take it that he's rather simple. He may not have any understanding about anything. He's just hiding from the cops. And yeah, now this kid has killed him.
Yeah, that was my interpretation, is that he was some kind of innocence, maybe, yeah, mentally handicapped. I don't know why he's got a hook for a hand, but like, why else would you crawl out of a hole in a wall? Like, anyone, yeah, rational thinker would go, that's probably going to scare people. Not a good look. But I took this Sherman as a much simpler Candyman.
No, they specifically say what happened was when the razors were found in the candy, the cops were looking for Sherman, and Sherman hid from the cops in the walls. So that's why he was coming out of the walls.
Okay.
And yeah, to your point, Stuart, in telling the story, William said the police swarmed him. And I'm, especially on the second viewing, jumped out at me. Oh, we're talking about bees. We're talking about swarms.
Oh, every time they made a bee pun, I caught it, yeah.
Yeah, it's not, I don't know if it's a pun or if it's just to keep it in our mind, you know, the...
A motif.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, we're taking the imagery of the first movie and we're recontextualizing it so that, I mean, hopefully, one thing I'd like to point out is there was a lot about the original movie I didn't really understand and never did, even after multiple viewings. So I think that this is an opportunity for Jordan Peele and Nia DaCosta to just take what worked with the original and shape it for their new vision. Again, I'm not expecting it to go as much back to the original as it will. Although I did know this Anthony was Baby Anthony.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. And I should have. I rewatched it. I knew it was Baby Anthony. I don't know why I didn't put two and two together until they spelled it out for me. But now Anthony is interested in the Candyman Sherman. And yeah, does that mean there is no Daniel Robitaille? I mean, they're referencing the first movie, so how does this all connect? But he's wanting to play the Candyman game with his girlfriend Brianna, and she's not having it.
Yeah, it's one thing in this film that a black person, till the very end, Brianna will do it, but a black person will never say Candyman five times. It's always going to be the white people in 2019.
William's sister will do it.
But that's a flashback. That's 1977 or...
Oh, true.
Yeah, I think they are trying to address, some of the issues I had with that first one, which I liked a whole lot, but I'm again, why doesn't Candyman go after the people that created this problem? And I think they're going to try to do that in this one.
Yeah, and I was not a problem for me. I actually saw it as a strength that PTSD is what Candyman was. Like, the community that is dealing with the oppression is going to be the ones that are going to speak of it. The ones that are oppressing, guilt won't allow them to talk about it, won't want to say the name, won't want to give it a label. So it, yes, you may want to turn, and I think this movie will want to turn Candyman into some kind of vigilante getting justice for downtrodden communities, but that wasn't what the original movie was.
And I think this film, again, it brought out some of those points that I didn't see in the first one, that what is Candyman, this expression of kind of just, this is our lot in life. This is their, what's that cream corn in Twin Peaks called? Garbimboza? Like, this is their pain and suffering. This is how they process that. And I thought that came out a lot clearer in this film. So again, another plus for this one.
Anthony is very inspired. You know, the girlfriend, not only does she not want to say the name in the mirror, but when he shows her, like, this is what I'm painting now, I'm actually going to show you Sherman being beat by cops in a oil painting, and that's what I'm going to submit to your show, the one that you're curating. And you can see she's uncomfortable with it for a lot of reasons. We will find out the main reason is that her father was also an artist and dealt in troubling imagery and committed suicide. That we have one flashback that shows her being the witness when he jumps out the window.
So underdeveloped.
I was so confused by this flashback because, yeah, we see a girl like addressing the father, but then it almost seems like Anthony's having the same nightmare he's up to, and he said he had a nightmare. Like, I got very confused by all of this, especially because we never go back to it. This is all of Brianna's backstory, is this 30-second dream we see.
It matters insofar as, like, she's going to be approached for a job just because of her constant relation to art and death. And, you know, that's a whole thing. Art and death being something people are drawn to, very emo or what have you. But, yeah, this father dream of, did you know your dad can fly? And then throwing himself out the window really did not. I thought there would be far more to it. I'm like, I was learning we were going to have a group of candy men. Was Brianna's dad going to be a candy man? I didn't know how this would relate. We're just supposed to, I guess, take from this. Well, what I take from this is the script had some rewrites, but in the final version,
I mean, they had a year to do reshoots. Like, yeah, this should have been fixed.
I take it as she's just traumatized from that. And now that her boyfriend starts going a little bit nuts with his art, she's been down that road once before.
Right. It's starting to trigger her, is the way that I take it. And who knows? You know, with the way that our minds work, sometimes we're also attracted to the things that scare us. Maybe the reason why she's dating Anthony is that she's always felt a connection between him and her troubled father. We don't really fully understand the relationship. I like them as a couple, but I feel like because this movie is edited the way that it is, choices were made to give some characters floor space that I don't feel pan out. And definitely with Brianna, she's a character that I would love to know more about, that I don't know why we have so much of her in this movie.
Well, here's the issue. This film is just barely over 90 minutes. That's including credits. That's including a bunch of shadow puppets. Like, do they not have any more characterization? Like, do they have to add more shadow puppets to cross the 90-minute mark?
No, I'll swear up and down, and I think when the Blu-ray comes out, it'll back me on this. There were tons of that were cut out.
That's what I figured. Why was it cut, though?
It doesn't feel like a reshot movie. It feels like a movie that was whittled down. It feels like there was a lot of other stuff. And my guess is, just going to go out on a limb, for a lot of people that wanted a traditional slasher, all this art talk, all of this stuff about the gallery scene, we don't care about Brianna and her curation problems. That is not what we came here for. Now, I personally think it's cool when we finally see the show and the fact that nobody is actually going up to Anthony's installation, say my name and all of that. I really like all of that. But it feels like to me, people at the top said, cut this down so it plays like a traditional slasher. And if there's scenes where characters are talking and no one dies, cut it.
I tend to agree, but I would hope that Jordan Peele wouldn't be the one saying that. And I would hope that since this is through Jordan Peele's Monkey Paw Productions, that he would have the clout to stop studio interference at that level from Universal. Maybe not, because this is a franchise and not an original property. But yeah, this is killing me when we see this white girl, Haley, walk up to the art. And I'm like, oh, she's going to be important. Who is she? Is she the... I realized lately that I see people as much younger than they are. So I'm like, is she in her 20s? Is she an art critic? When they're talking about stay away from the art critic, is she the art critic? Is she the daughter of the gallery owner? Who's she? I only know she's Haley and she matters because she has a necklace with her name on it, which, by the way, movie makers, if you did that for every character, so much easier for me.
Yeah, they'll hold off on this. We see her as the lone person in this very crowded exhibit who actually cares to maybe try out the summoning. Anthony has made it his dare. He didn't display the imagery of the police beating on Sherman. He made a replica of his bathroom mirror. You open it up. It's actually pretty cool. And there's a whole, like, blacklight diorama going on inside. Kind of looks like the Row House. There's a lot of discussion about what it might mean and what have you. But the expectation is that the participants are told about Candyman and encouraged to say his name 5 times. It doesn't happen because there's just too many other With It artists that have bigger installations. And
I don't know. None of that art looked very exciting to me.
I kind of agree.
Yeah, but nobody likes this art. That's the thing, is I think had people liked this art, I thought, honestly, this was like modern art and he just had the painting. When he tells the critic to open it, I'm like, okay, now this is kind of cool. But only Haley and the critic are paying it any attention, and only Haley seems to like it. The critic's not going to say it, and nobody else is even wandering around. Had it been a quote-unquote hit, then yeah, everybody probably would have been saying Candyman. If he had done more, maybe around the mirror, if the mirror was... I always love that graffiti painting of Candyman with his mouth open from the first one. If there was that and the mirror was in the mouth area instead of a hole, maybe people would have been lining up to say Candyman 5 times. But here... it's just completely ignored and ripped apart by that critic in a conversation that about whose fault is gentrification. And she says, you people. And I think he's like, blacks? No, artists.
I thought that was kind of a funny joke.
Yeah, there was a lot being thrown at us. A lot of big words, a lot of ideas about... I think if you boil it down, all you really need to understand is a white lady art critic walks up to this art, doesn't want to give it full consideration. And I think that's the point. Early on, when you're a struggling artist, he's only in here because of his girlfriend. Let's kind of face it. Like, the gallery owner didn't even want to exhibit his work. She got him in here. Nobody cares about a new artist until there's a reason and something sensationalistic, you know, like it could be argued. Would we care about Van Gogh if he didn't go crazy and cut off his ear? Is the backstory, is the macabre details of certain artists the reason why we hold on to their work? Is the meta reasons what makes the art interesting and not the actual craft? I mean, certainly, I think that can be, in many cases, when you look at famous artists, the legend that they create for themselves that is bigger than the work itself.
And you've made some very interesting points, Stuart. Maybe those points are made in the film. I don't know. I wish that stuff... I kind of see it, like, there's some killings, and they're like the Say My Name killings, and Anthony actually smiles and likes that. I'm like, okay, I kind of see what they're getting at, but this conversation with this art critic, I'm like, yeah, artists gentrify things. That's, like, where it stops for me. Like, I don't understand anything else.
It feels like we lost a scene for sure. Like, they cut over to Troy. He's saying something bitchy. His boyfriend is saying, maybe we should try it. I think they cut that, right?
Yeah, I thought, you're going to kill the gay couple first? Like, wow, that's as bad as killing the black guy first. Like, I was shocked that they were going to go there, but they don't.
Well, maybe they did, and then somebody like you put that on a comment card, and they went, eh, we are trying to be progressive here. Maybe we won't kill Troy. To which I say, well, then you've suddenly created all this space for Troy, and he doesn't do anything. I mean, he's funny. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a good performance, but why is he here?
Yeah, doesn't he leave the film at this point? Does he come back ever?
He does come back for a dinner later on, Jacob, but...
That's right, yeah. But it seems like whatever point he had has exited the film.
Yes, agreed. And then, really weird, like all of a sudden, Anthony is drunk and fighting with a character we've never seen before or again.
Yes.
And the guy seems to be complimenting a previous exhibit that he did, but he calls him a jackal and is suddenly screaming at the gallery owner that he's sleeping with his assistants, and his girlfriend has to, like, whisk him off to the L stop. And I don't get it. What happened?
No, well, that guy was actually unintentionally insulting. I mean, he calls Anthony Tony.
I've heard worse.
Yeah, that is a nickname for Anthony. Like, I've usually called Anthony's Tonys in my life, unless they've stated otherwise.
And what he said was, remember, Anthony painted that piece of all the white fists punching Sherman. And what this guy says is, I love your say my name art because you opened it up. And you've taken all this shitty art and put it in a warehouse where it never should be seen. Where'd you find all these crappy-ass paintings? And this is the art that Anthony did and was really proud of.
Oh.
And so now this guy's saying, your art is shit, and I think you're...
Oh, I didn't understand that. Okay.
You're making fun of bad artists. Where did you get these paintings? And Anthony's response is, I painted them.
Okay. All right. Okay. None of that translated, but you have helped me understand why that man ended up being insulting when it didn't look like he was trying to pick a fight. Okay. So, yeah. All right. So Anthony was a little bit drunk, felt slighted, and made a big scene as he was whisked away. And, yeah, Clive, the gallery owner, is correctly identified as someone that likes to sleep with his assistants. It's kind of ironic that he's sitting there after the show is over mumbling that Brianna has made a big mistake mixing, you know, sex with your work. But obviously that's what he's doing here with his assistant Jerrica, and they're going to be the next kill.
The first kills? I mean, other than Samuel off screen, these are the first Candyman kills.
Right. And it seems that, again, maybe I'm looking for these stuff. Maybe a little Hellraiser, a little Clive Barker, in the fact that she, like, not only wants to have sex in front of this installation, Say My Name, and to summon Candyman, but she's got, like, chains and stuff. Like, she suddenly is, like, attaching herself to the belt of Clive, and they're gonna, I don't know, it feels like it could get into bondage and Cenobite territory.
It felt just weird, like some kind of umbilical connection. I don't understand the purpose of that, because it's not like she's wearing a sex garment. So she'd been wearing that as like a belt all night that she could hook onto him. And then, I mean, you've got to theoretically take your pants off. Maybe they'll just unzip. But, you know, for sex, you'd probably remove that. So I don't know what this connection did. But the movie I went to wasn't Hellraiser here, because once she says Candyman five times, she's lifted in the air, her throat is slit. This is Nightmare on Elm Street 1, right? Tina's death, where there's an invisible killer throwing you around the room. And
that's the thing. You will never see Candyman in the physical world until the very end, I think. But it's always through mirrors. So when I was watching this with my wife, she's like, why isn't he there? I'm like, I think he's there. We just don't see him. He's always through the mirrors for whatever reason, because that's a Candyman thing, mirrors. And that's the artistic thing maybe they want to do here. But we'll see him, like, I think we'll see him on, there's a installation that's just showing some film footage. We'll see him in that or something as this kill is going on. But he's never on the physical plane with his victims.
No, he's like slashing a projector screen in the mirror, and the real projector screen is cutting apart. That's just vandalism, Candyman. Why are you doing that?
And I do think maybe what the way to take this is Candyman isn't strong enough to have a physical presence yet. He is still emerging. He needs the blood. He needs the believers. He needs the hype. Remember, it was always about, like, I want to be famous. The more lips that are saying my name, the more powerful I become. Anthony is at home at this point, looking into his own mirror. And we see, like, a shot of a bee landing on the other side. Like, it's the reflective side of the glass. And I get the sense that this Candyman kill is happening in part because he's willing it. He's seeing this stuff in the gallery inside his own mirror.
Another thing that isn't in this movie that I thought would be is more investigation into Anthony as the killer, because...
Oh, I thought that was going to be a major plot.
Yes, I did too at this point. He got in the argument with the gallery owner. He has motive. against the gallery owner. He doesn't have much of an alibi.
On the news, when he's watching it, they're saying it's the Say My Name murders. Like, they know that's the name of his installation. Like, they're seeing people killed and having Say My Name written next to them. Like, I thought this was going to be a major thing, just like with Helen and her getting investigated by the police.
Yes.
I see what you're saying, but the way it's coming off to me is it's making his work notorious. And God knows controversy is what sells art. Most modern art lives by offending somebody. So the idea that this work, you know, no one wants to make that full call out of like, I mean, we're not going to say that this work killed anybody, but isn't it amazing that this gallery owner and his girl were found right next to the mirror? And again, that, you know, becomes the thing that they can talk about in the media, is that it is connected to Anthony's work. Yeah, when we see, we cut to him watching TV, he's smiling about it. Brianna is horrified that her boss is dead, but Anthony is like, yeah, they're saying my name. They're saying Anthony McCoy.
Which, on the first kill, I'm okay with that. But I just thought at some point we were going to see him brought in for questioning, similar to Helen in the first film. But they're going to underplay that until the very, very end. But I do like these kills just from a slasher point of view. The gore is good. The effects are good. The floating around, the fear of the theater owner as he leaves the girl there and then gets kind of smacked around and floating and dragged. I'm liking this as a horror kill. Now, we're 35 minutes in. If I was in this for a body count, we're waiting a little long, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I think it's really, I mean, goes without saying that they've done the art gallery kill better than Candyman 3. But, I mean, it's just not an environment or a world where slasher movies have taken it seriously enough that it would be a place of a kill. And the fact that we've had this art gallery murder and our killer is an artist who's seeming to will it through his installation piece, I'm finding this very satisfying. But you're right. If you were a gore hound, or if you were just wanting somebody to get to it and get a body count, this might be a little weird. You might be wondering, what is this movie about?
What's weird to me is when we get to the next kill, this critic, Finley invites Anthony over to her place, and they, you know, we'll see this long sequence of Anthony looking in the mirror, and there's Candyman looking back, and the bees and all that, and so I get it, like, you're turning into Candyman, so here's gonna be another cool kill, right? That's gonna set up Anthony as this suspect that the police are gonna, no, he's gonna leave, and then we're gonna pull really far away from this building, like, if you're squinting, maybe you'll see this critic, like, get raised in the air and thrown against the glass. Like, we had a great kill, and then this is your follow-up?
No, this is a great kill.
I love it.
Yes, this is an amazing kill, because how many times have I seen this kind of thing? But to have this camera pull back and this depersonalization of the death as she's being flung against the glass, I found this to be a very artistic slasher death that was satisfying on multiple levels. I don't think this will ever work on a phone screen or a TV screen, but you see this in theaters, this is a great death.
Maybe my problem was I was watching it on a drive-in screen.
That is possibly it, because seeing this in the theater, that's my favorite death of the movie.
Agreed. And I feel like what they're doing here is that they're kind of taking artistic shots. Like, I mean, yeah, the composition is such that you may even miss that there's a murder going on. It's really all about the texture of the Marina City corncob buildings. And so it's like this little piece of it.
Yeah, it feels more like a Rear Window Hitchcock shot than anything. Like, just where you see this whole building and you can see in all the windows.
God help me, I was getting a little Poltergeist 3, which was also set in the Chicago skyscraper and played a lot with mirrors. There's just some cool moments here. They extend the moment maybe too long, but basically this Finley critic has asked Anthony over here because now she's changed her tune, right? Like, before, oh, your work is cliched and this is garbage and you don't know anything about the ghetto and I know more than anything. And now that your name is hot, like, the media is talking about deaths and all of this stuff, I want to write a whole big thing on Candyman, and you can be, like, my source for all of that. And so, I mean, that's why he's here, is that he's notorious. And, you know, we have a couple moments where, like, we think she's dying in the bathroom. He dares her to say the Candyman name when she goes off to the restroom. She ends up opening the door, not dead, but if you look behind her, Candyman is there in the shot. I just felt like there was a lot of fun kind of Poltergeist 3, God help me, mirror play that, again, it's not gore. If that was what you were looking for, and that is certainly what the first three movies promised you, this is a different kind of horror. It is one that's playing with optics and sound design and, yeah, where's Waldo kind of, do you see Candyman way in the back?
Yeah, because while she's in the bathroom, Anthony has this whole, you know, right before this movie, I saw the trailer for Last Night in Soho, and you see there the two different people doing the mirror thing, and now we see it here with Anthony and Sherman making the same movements, you know, in the mirror. And then, yeah, when the bathroom door opens, you just see Sherman's fur coat kind of go into a towel closet or something. It was, yeah, I was really enjoying the scene. High point of the movie for me is right here in the second act around this art critic kill when she obviously, by horror movie rules, deserves a brutal death. She's fake, as fake as I always assume art critics are. You're going to say what you think the readers want to hear. You can make and break careers, and now you're going to make Anthony's because he's related to these deaths, and you're basically going to ride his coattails because now he's going to be famous, so you should be the critic who quote-unquote discovers him.
Right.
By horror movie rules, that falseness makes this death very motivated. And another reason why Anthony would be a suspect for her death is nobody else knew he was there. He just said, I'm going out. And this critic ripped his work apart. So again, somebody who, if found dead along with the gallery owner, you'd think, hey, Anthony might have killed these people.
Yeah, instead we'll see his wife with a bunch of other art critics at dinner somewhere, and they'll get a text, and it's the husband. It's this art critic's husband who is the suspect.
That was actually kind of funny, but yeah, here's a question to ask, and I don't know that the movie, I'm sure it isn't conclusive, but I want to see if you guys are picking up what I think that they're going for, is that we also notice that the bee sting is getting worse, right? Like, started out as a little bobble on his hand and has now seemed to be crawling up his arm, even kind of getting up on his neck with a honeycomb pattern at this point. We have very quick insert shots of him working on paintings. It's not really clear in this cut, but I think we are to understand that he is painting a lot of Candyman work. He mentioned to the critic that he was going to do a whole show based on this now. So I think that he's becoming more and more consumed with this legend. That's why he is turning, right? If he could turn himself off from the subject matter, he probably, the bee sting would go away.
I just kept thinking he needs to go to a goddamn hospital, get that thing looked at.
He will eventually, but I think what backs that theory up, Stuart, of yours, is that, what does he do? He goes to the university that Helen was...
UIC, yeah.
Okay, and he gets what, I guess they still have her files.
Seems illogical, but kind of fun that she has a micro cassette recorder still lying around.
And yeah, he's going to start, again, really getting into this case, and again, walks into a glass elevator. No, this is not a Willy Wonka movie, but it's a Candyman movie. So yeah, we'll see him starting to transform as the more he investigates.
Right. He wouldn't be Sherman in that mirror above the elevator had he not stolen the microcassette and listened to what Virginia Madsen is saying.
And when he's listening to Virginia Madsen there, and I'd have to go back and rewatch the first movie, because I don't know if they had her record some new stuff or if every line here is from the first film.
No, it's new. They credit it in the credits itself. They say that she came back to do this.
I saw her credited as the voice, but I didn't know if it was brand new or archival.
It's brand new. I can even tell you why, because she's now saying things that are going along with the themes of this movie, which were not the themes of the first movie. What I hear her saying in all of her thesis expounding is that this is a community, in order to protect their children, they were afraid of the police, they were summoning, they were using rituals to summon. And suddenly we have an idea very contradictory to the idea that you summon a killer on you because you say his name in a bathroom mirror. You have the idea that a community that's abused by the police suddenly is calling Candyman for backup. But the idea is he will now help them protect the children.
But there's no records of Candyman slaughtering cops until the very end of this film, right? I caught that and I just didn't understand it because we've never seen that in a Candyman film.
Yes. It feels like they are starting in this moment trying to turn things into where they want them to be and not where they were in that original movie.
There were the cops killed by Candyman when Helen was a prisoner that allowed Helen to escape.
But again, white woman doing that, very different than abusive cops. I mean, those cops were right to have arrested her. I just want to point out they were not going beyond their duties, and it was not a racially motivated attack. If anything, it might have been sexist. But here, what I'm hearing is you summon things to protect your community. That is what the people of Cabrini were doing. And that was what she was learning by studying all of her graffiti. Remember, that was her whole mission, was to look at graffiti and urban myth. Her conclusions was, we never heard what her thesis was. We finally learned it. And that is, Candyman is what is the hex you put on bad cops.
And I just want to call out, when we had the puppet show telling Helen's story earlier, when Helen is talking here, we're getting that Philip Glass score callbacks to it. And it makes me realize how lackluster the score for this movie is, because that Philip Glass music is just so gorgeous and haunting. I wish they'd used it a bit more.
You're right. I like the Philip Glass score, but at the same time, you got to be careful. Like, you don't want to just drown the soundtrack with it. They're trying to do something new. This stuff, a lot of it is like vocal stuff that we've heard in other Jordan Peele movies. It feels a little bit like the Omen-ish chanting from Get Out. And I like it okay.
Yeah, it was all right.
I agree. It's not as catchy. But you don't want everything to be that Philip Glass. They use it exactly at the right moment.
But they tease it during these flashback moments. And
oh, I didn't notice that. I didn't even hear it until the last scene.
No, no. Anytime that they're back in the events of that movie, they're going to bring in some strings of it.
Okay. So Anthony is starting to look, Arnie, you mentioned this earlier. I assume you saw what I saw. Seth Brundle, Brundlefly.
Yes, I put that in my notes.
Right. Like when he's picking off his fingernails and all of that, that feels like direct referencing to Cronenberg's Fly.
Exactly. That was one of the most gross things I ever saw growing up, was him pulling out his own fingernail. And to see Anthony do it here, I'm like, well, it's too late. They're going to have to amputate this thing. You're going full Jared Leto, Requiem for a Dream. You didn't get it.
They're going to stick a hook in there. That's what I'm waiting for, that hand to fall off and him to put a hook in it.
Well, you would think William would be all on this. Anthony does go to see him at the laundromat again. Funny little Barker moment. You see what he's reading? Weave World. Nobody liked Weave World, but Clive Barker.
But he is in textiles.
Yes, I guess that was the thinking. Like, what Clive do that might work in a laundromat setting?
And this must be very humorous for people in the Clive Barker, because I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
Weave World is Hellraiser if Cenobites lived in a carpet.
What?
Yeah, seriously, like, Between the Threads is a fantasy world.
Okay, moving on. I'll just leave it at that.
They haven't made a movie of it, so you know it's not the best.
They didn't make a movie of Great and Secret Show either, but that's his best written work. So I just think that Weave World, I didn't like it. I think there's a lot of Barker fans who love that one.
Oh, okay. Well, I stand corrected and just wanted to point out there's another little Clive Barker touch. And here is where we get, I think, the idea introduced that Daniel Robitaille is one of many Candy Men. Like, this movie shouldn't be called Candy Man. There are almost multiverses. There are, like, every 10 years.
Yeah, Candyman entered the Candyverse. That's what
they said. Yeah, it's, all of a sudden, they're trying to tell us that it's not that we've written Tony Todd out. It's just that we want to pick up on a different incarnation. And that Anthony is one of five.
Yeah, every generation gets a Candyman. It's not necessarily a multiverse, but that in every generation, one is born. Like a Slayer from Buffy.
Come on, I want the Nick Cage noir Candyman. Give me that. But no, that, I find that interesting that, yeah, if we are going to take this story of racism and suffering and mythologize it and turn it into a campfire story, it's just going to keep happening. We're not going to solve this situation, so we're going to have multiple Candymen. That totally works for me until we get to Anthony's turn, because it doesn't follow all those past instances of either cops or racist white plantation owners going after an artist. Like, none of that stuff is following. followed in the creation of this newest Candyman.
This is where we finally get the story. They finally confirm that, yes, Daniel Robitaille is in this mythology, direct sequel, 1890s, white woman, smeared in honey, hook for hand. All of that did happen. They haven't written that out. It's just not necessarily the only instance of a Candyman. And so the guy from the 70s, the fourth one, and now he's passing the baton, or the hook, as it were. This is where it becomes clear, I think, that we understand Anthony is totally going to turn into Candyman. And so what does that mean? Should we be worried for Brianna that he's going to kill her? Should we be thinking of her as Gina Davis in The Fly?
I never worried about that, because you got to say Candyman's name 5 times in the mirror. If she doesn't do that, she's fine.
Yeah, I feel like it suddenly is starting to become her movie. We get these scenes about where, yeah, she's been hanging out with these New York people, and they, because of the notoriety of Anthony, are offering her jobs to work at a gallery. And
Troy did mention to her, you have to deal with this storage unit full of dad's art. And this person hiring her wants her dead dad's art for display also. So, like,
right.
Both sides of these traumatic, blood-soaked men in her life, she's being used for access to their art.
Yeah, I get it. The art world is bloodsuckers. They don't care about you. They want to exploit pain. They think it's cool when misery and trauma happens to people because it makes for the painting to be more authentic. And so, yeah, if you want to sell art, then have a terrible life, you know, like that's what's going on here. But for me, and I like this actress and I like these scenes and I even believe in the reality of them, it just doesn't feel appropriate to switch the focus on her when it's Anthony, right? Like Anthony's the one that's becoming Candyman, and I feel like he drops out of the middle of this movie.
I felt like you had to switch the point of view, though, because if Anthony's becoming Candyman, he's no longer our reliable first-person point of view. I did think that it was a smart choice, if he was becoming the other, than to go to a human point of view. It seemed natural to me that we would switch to her at this point.
I think you gotta pick a protagonist, and sure, make it Brianna, and all the Anthony stuff's going on in the background. She's a Helen type in this film that's gonna interact with Candyman because of her involvement in the art world or whatnot, but to me it just gets very confusing when you start shifting things around, and yeah, it feels like just scenes cut out of this film. Just, I guess it's not film anymore, it's all digital, but just ripping out scenes here, there needs to be more connective tissue to me. It feels like we're getting snippets more than a cohesive story.
And never is that more true than in the next moment, when all of a sudden that Haley character that, you know, we barely paid attention at the gallery show is suddenly hanging out with 4 girlfriends in the bathroom.
This was the trailer, and I had no, and when I started seeing the scene, I remembered it being like the first trailer, and I'm like, this has nothing to do with the movie. What is this scene?
That's the crazy thing, because I remember it from the trailers. I'm like, oh my gosh, this movie's going to be so good. Look at this scene in the trailer. It looks amazing. And then I get to it in the film. I'm like, oh, did they just put this in because they needed more kills and had to hit that 90-minute mark? Like, this feels so out of place.
Here's my prediction. I already kind of said it, but like the previous moment was Brianna and Troy is getting more and more invested in what's going on. We even had a moment of him considering summoning, and he's like, well, that's not what black people do in Chicago. And the white boyfriend was like, but I kind of want to do it. I feel like this was probably their death scene. And I don't know. Cue cards told them that audiences didn't want to see them die. I didn't want them to die. I didn't necessarily want to see Troy killed, but it feels weird that it's Haley. I mean, really weird.
Yeah, shouldn't there be a scene where, again, there's these murders going on the news. Oh, the Say My Name killer is now the Candyman killer, and there's this old myth, blah, blah, blah. And so these impressionable college students go into the bathroom and, like, line... Like, this feels like such a traditional slasher, the way they line up in front of that mirror and all say it in unison. Like, I saw it in the trailer, and I'm like, wow, this looks super good. But in the context of this film, like, that's not what this film is, and it feels so out of place.
It does, and there's the black girl in the stall who's, like, picked on by these white women, and she's hiding from them. And I don't know what school this is, but even the picked on girl has Bose headphones. I just want to point out.
Yeah, it's like a junior college they call out. It's I thought it was a high school, but it's not. It's some kind of college.
But in the Cabrini neighborhood. The reason why Haley was there is she was local. Like, the gallery would have been right there. And so here's the sticky part. We're hearing that the media is blowing up Anthony's work so that, yeah, people in New York now want to exhibit him. And yet the phenomenon is only still happening in Cabrini Green. And why would that be? I mean, in the age of viral videos and such, you know, if there can be a Tide Pod challenge, wouldn't there be...
a Candyman challenge?
Thousands and thousands of people doing Say My Name.
This is what's on TikTok?
It's right there with the Milk Crate challenge.
I feel like that would make the movie too unwieldy to suddenly say that all over the world. Not to mention if Anthony is the one that has to sit in front of the mirror and be the guy that goes through and kills them. Like, that's a lot of work. All of a sudden, like, you're doing that all day long, every day. I'm digging what this movie's trying to do by keeping it a growing legend. But I don't know, with the media reporting on it and all of that, it's just kind of confusing. But I will say this, I like the scene. As far as Nia DaCosta staging a kill scene that is much needed by this point in the movie, I like the way that she'll use the mirror compact falling on the ground to show us some of the kills, or we'll see, you know, blood leaking under the stall, what have you. The suggestion of horror is well done.
I agree.
Yep.
I like it. It's got good horror movie kills, but this is coming at exactly the 1 hour mark. And this isn't the movie I thought I was in. This would fit great in a Nightmare on Elm Street film, but this has seemed far more serious. So to kill a bunch of pretty white girls who do look like a bunch of TikTokers did not make sense to me. And this girl hiding in the stall who we'll never see again. All this does is drive home something to me. Candyman doesn't kill black folk.
Well, yeah, let's dig into that. Like, if that's what I heard, that Virginia Madsen is saying it, that it's really about summoning, suddenly Candyman looks like a crusader, right? Like, maybe he's a vigilante, maybe he does it through bad means, maybe morally you don't agree with taking law into your own hands, but he's a superhero, right? He's Batman. So why attack these people? They're, unless you just consider whiteness itself as part of the oppression.
I don't think the film ever tries to make that point.
Right. I didn't take it to be that. So yeah. I guess I'm wondering why he would bother with these chicks.
I mean, I think he kills everyone who says his name, you know?
Well, then black people will be killed. I mean, like, that's, there's just no way around that. Suddenly he cannot be the guy that's going to save the communities from white oppression. He's going to be the guy that kills anybody that says his name five times.
Yeah, he's the wrong hero to pick.
Yeah, so it feels like they're trapped between the old way. What I'm talking about with the five times in the mirror is the old way. And where they're trying to send this movie feels like a chasm they can't bridge. Like, there's just something about that that, at least in one viewing, doesn't make sense to me.
Two viewings still doesn't make sense.
All right, maybe it will never will.
I mean, I do feel like this is put in there to appease a horror audience who may not have been satisfied with the first hour of this film.
Yeah, it totally feels that way.
Yeah, I agree. And much about this movie, I like all the scenes in it. I mean, I just want to put it out there, but I feel like I'm not getting all the scenes in the movie. I feel like things are dropping out and things have been removed and excised.
I mean, characters are dropping out and never coming back.
It's real confusing.
What's really, really funny to me is you go from the bathroom scene into the scene of Brianna with her supposed new boss discussing the New York job. And in neon above them, it says, "You're obviously in the wrong place." And all I could think of is, yes, if you want more scenes like that bathroom kill, you're obviously in the wrong place.
Yeah. And again, this is kind of the frustration I felt at times with DaCosta's other film, Little Woods, because I watched that trailer. Oh, looks like a drug heist smuggling film. And there are times where I thought it was ramping up to be that in that film, but it is not that kind of film. And that's fine. Like, that film works for what it is. But I think trying to sell Candyman, which I does have a following in the horror scene, I think a big following, like trying to do this trade-off where, hey, we're going to go way more artsy and not have any of those kind of kills and everything. I think people are going to find that very frustrating.
I agree. This movie has set up challenges that it can't meet, and it is trying to elevate at the same time it's trying to serve the audience in the past. And before you know it, it's over. Like, the weirdest thing of all is, just as I'm getting into this, and I recognize there's some tonal shifts and not everything's making sense, but I'm really enjoying all of this. And then all of a sudden, we're like racing into the climax. All of a sudden, yeah, we have Anthony going to the hospital, realizing that he's baby Anthony, that he was born in Cabrini, confronting his mom.
And this was bugging me on my first viewing, because honestly, around the time of the bathroom kill, I got in my own head. And another reason I wanted to see this twice, I was thinking more meta about the movie. I was checking my watch for the first time and thinking, how close are we to the climax?
Mm-hmm.
When are things going to be spelled out? And all of a sudden it hit me, this whole movie, Brianna's been telling Anthony, call your mother. I went to see your mother. You were supposed to meet your mother. I'm like, wait, this mother thing's gonna Vanessa Williams.
Mm-hmm. They truly say the best for last. Although, not that Vanessa Williams.
Wrong one, yeah.
I do love her here. She's better in this movie than she was in the original.
Yes.
She's gotten much better at acting, yes.
I agree.
Very naturalistic. When he tries to say the Candyman name and she does that clap and hold her finger to her lips and like, yeah. Don't say that. That is a priceless moment.
Oh, I mean, they put that in the trailer. It's so good.
She's really, again, I find myself in so many of the supporting moments saying, I want more time with these people. Do I want a Candyman series or do I just want the 30 minutes that has been cut out of this movie? I don't know, but I can't believe that this is the only scene I'm going to get of Anna Marie. It feels unfair. We get cheated that she has one scene basically begging him to, I don't know, don't investigate Candyman. Too late. She can see he's turned into a honeycomb. And then we're in the climax of this film. Suddenly, Brianna is like kidnapped and in the church.
Yeah, Artie, you saw it twice, so explain all of this to me. Explain William, his plot, his motives. Explain it all, because I completely lost during this last part.
I have no clue, because once he leaves Vanessa Williams' house, we get, you know, Vanessa Williams does tell, it's the last flashback, the last puppet show until the credits at least. She's going to say, Helen wasn't the crazy killer. Helen saved your life.
Right.
That's the big reveal here. Old news for anyone who'd seen the first movie. New news for baby Anthony. And then all of a sudden he's like hypnotized. He's just going to wander through Cabrini. And now it all starts with Brianna and her brother. She's moving out now, except he's not there. So she's going to go look with William at the laundromat.
I have no idea why she knows about the laundromat.
Yeah, was there any discussion about her moving out? Like, again, this all caught me off guard. I didn't see any of this coming.
She definitely was triggered. Again, if you think about, like, her father and all of that, and certainly Troy is putting that in her ear of, like, you need to get away from this Basquiat art ogre, you know, like, he's telling her, get away.
Yeah, he's saying that, but I never feel like there's a discussion. Here's the thing. This movie is all A-plot. There are no subplots, I feel like. Nothing about Brianna and her relationship with Anthony and justifying this moving out. It just, all of a sudden, she's moving out. Okay.
Brianna and her job is the closest we have to a B-plot.
And that never gets developed.
I feel like there's a lot of B-plots, and they just aren't fulfilled. We don't... Haley is a B-plot. You know, like, I just... There are so many characters I have such curiosity about, and, yeah, they're not even here for a kill. Traditionally, you would think you'd have all of these characters because they're bodies to whack later, but that is not how we are to experience them. And Brianna is, yeah, all of a sudden kidnapped by William, who is phoning the police and telling them, come to this church, the Say My Name killer is here, as he is dressing Anthony in his trance as Candyman.
And why is Anthony in a trance? He was in a trance before he ever saw William, so Candyman has put him in a fugue?
He did go into one of the row houses. There was a flash of light, felt like the gunshot or whatever. It's almost like a time loop thing. It's almost like he... When he got killed, he went into the row house, you know, because we'll know that he's going to be shot by the police. I feel like he walked into that row house the night before, and at this point, he is no longer Anthony, the way I read it.
I understand that, yeah, he is in this state where, like, he doesn't even flinch when his hand gets cut off and the hook gets jabbed in there. But what is William ranting about? Like, the baby has come full circle, like... Why was the baby Anthony supposed to die in that first film? Was that going to do something for Candyman? I don't understand any of the motives here or what he's ranting about.
Okay, here's the closest thing I can give you. In the first film, Baby Anthony's death, Candyman didn't just want to kill a baby. Candyman wanted people to talk about Candyman.
Yes. Right.
And Baby Anthony was going to be the sacrifice that would get everybody talking about Candyman again and down in the future. And the reverse happened. What Vanessa Williams says here is after Baby Anthony survived...
Because of Helen, yes.
Everybody there agreed, we're not talking about Candyman no more.
Right.
Nobody's going to talk about Candyman.
Are they going to go, oh, look, here's the guy that was that baby and now he's Candyman. Let's all talk about it. Is that Williams' plan?
I think it's more like if I'm doing the work that wasn't done back then and killing Baby Anthony by doing it this way. He is dying and thus... Yeah, it doesn't literally follow that anyone... First of all, there's no community in Cabrini Green that's connected with that neighborhood anymore. It's like these urban myths don't exist as gossip anymore. But we are to understand that in killing Anthony, he is going to bring back, summon a new version of Candyman, the fifth incarnation.
And I stated it earlier, but again, horror films especially, like, you gotta set your rules up and play by those rules. And here they've told us Candyman after Candyman after Candyman's created by cops and white racism and all that. But now here's just a black guy, like, just making Candyman to... I guess this Candyman's gonna have different purposes.
He's setting it up, though, so white cops kill him. Now, God forbid if black cops had shown up or woman cops, but...
Yeah, he's just as responsible for his death as the cops. Like, he's like, yeah, the killer's here. Like, he set all this up.
Yeah, what he says is, we need Candyman. Killing Anthony is worth it to get Candyman back. Now, what I cannot connect and rectify is, does he not have any resentment as to what happened to his sister? Because we'll have a quick flashback.
Very confusing to me. I thought it was present day, and then it clicked. Oh, okay, that was William again.
1977, after Sherman got beaten by the cops, and razor blades were still showing up in candy, I guess that Candyman's first kill is little William's sister goes into the bathroom, says the name five times, and Sherman comes out of the shower to hook her and float away. So why would William want that to return?
I don't know.
Can't figure it.
I don't know.
Can't puzzle that out. Again, if he wanted Candyman to return to kill cops, great. But if he wants him to come back and kill more of his sisters or family members he doesn't like, I don't get it.
It does seem like he wants Candyman to come back as a Black Avenger. And yet, that doesn't make sense for what we know about Candyman and killing his sister.
Maybe he's trying to change the MO. Like, he used to hurt us, but we can make it that he can now hurt them.
I just don't know why William doesn't turn himself into Candyman. Like, he seems right. to be really into it. He studied it. So Candyman should be possessing him, just like what happened to Anthony.
Maybe it has to be Anthony, though. And don't ask me why, but...
Because he was the baby.
Yeah.
That's all they're going to tell us in this.
I appreciate where they're trying to take this movie, but the Conjuring spell is a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, this ending makes no sense, and it's a shame, because I have been really liking this movie up until this point. Where if this seemed motivated, if this seemed logical, if I understood anything about what William's trying to do, and he's like, oh, we got to make you Candyman-ish, here's a coat, here's a hook for a hand. But all of this, it feels like there should have been a Candyman behind this. Like you've said, Stuart, Anthony's getting the honeycomb pattern from that bee sting. Something else should have been going on, but... This doesn't make sense. And I watched it twice and I cannot circle the square.
Yeah. And maybe future movies can try to help finesse, but it seems to me like too many cooks. I know there's three screenwriters, plus there are studio execs and, you know, a year of testing with audiences and changing and reshooting. It just feels like nobody was confident in whatever the original message was. And they tried to change things up here in a way that just feels more obvious. Like, okay, suddenly Candyman is the good guy, but then should I be afraid of him? Are we to be cheering him on when we get to this end? That was never anything that I ever did for Candyman. I was never happy that he was killing people in the mirror. And now I think of that we're supposed to think it's great that Brianna is going to summon him in the rearview mirror of the squad car.
Because Candyman does not believe blue lives matter.
This does feel like something we would have seen in part two or three. It is such a left turn. Yeah, Candyman's going to pop out and just kill all those evil racist cops. Like, that's never what this series was about. Maybe it should be about it. Maybe that's a totally valid topic to get into. I thought this was going to lean into that kind of thing a whole lot more. It comes off kind of confused by the end of this one. But the way they go about that, Rihanna's like, just turn the mirror and let me see myself, and then I'll give you the answer you want. Like, this does feel like a cornier, more typical slasher ending.
Yeah, and the cop just being so obvious with the, you're going to say our cop was righteous in the shoot or you're going to jail. It's like, come on, can we have some nuance here? Hashtag not all anybody, okay?
I mean, I feel like this whole film has been about nuance. Maybe that's because I don't understand all the art speak they're getting into, but I would have expected it to be smarter.
Well, yeah, it feels like they're pandering at this point. We all know that we're tired of seeing videos of black people being killed by law enforcement. So let's just turn it into some vindication for that, which is not what they built. It's not what Candyman was about. It was not what I was hearing. Anything that was what was happening in the first half of this movie. And so you're right, a real left turn that, well, you know what, that first Candyman movie shit the bed when she had to put on that bald cap wig and suddenly she's the hook-handed killer. You know, like, they never knew how to end this series. They never knew exactly what they had here. But we do have Tony Todd, the Bees remake Anthony's face so that it's not Yaya anymore. It's good old Tony and some CGI, I think.
Yes, they de-aged him. They made him back to the way he used to be. And there's the monologue here, and I couldn't tell. I think this is Yaya's voice, but they've just ramped up the bass to make it more Tony Todd-ish.
Oh, I thought it was Tony Todd.
I'm asking. I'm not positive of which one it is.
Especially the tell everyone at the very end. That sounded very much like Tony Todd to me.
No, that was Tony Todd coming out of his mouth. But the monologue that, like, Brianna's hearing in her head while the cops are dying.
No, that's Yaya.
Okay.
Because at this point, we don't know that it's Tony Todd. It's just in the way that they staged it. Again, this is a director that's very talented in composition. I like the way that all of a sudden she's inside the squad car and somebody comes running out of the row house, like bleeding from the gut, the gullet or whatever. And yeah, when we see Candyman, he's speaking like Yaya. And we see in the reflection, as he's walking around the car, it is Yaya. But he's got a lot of bees flying around him and there's kind of hiding his face. It's almost like the bees are trying to remake him into the Candyman before, but
it was kind of reminding me of Barker's original story, The Forbidden, too, where, you know, Candyman isn't all that well described and such. So I was kind of wondering if they were going back to the original text a little bit with this final version of Candyman.
Are there just enough fans of the original movie that they were just going to be on their feet saying, yay, Tony Todd? I feel like you've really confused things.
There's not enough Tony Todd. I think if maybe he got a whole ending.
You've confused it by making him Tony Todd now. I thought this was him in the fifth incarnation. He has to be the first incarnation now? I don't know.
I thought they were all there. Like, you asked about what if he went viral. There's now six Candymen out there to do different appearances. It's like Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton.
Okay. It's a weird reference, but maybe it is like that. I don't know, but I don't like this ending. I'll just put it bluntly. I really feel like, just like in the original movie, they didn't know what they were going to do at the end. And they just go for an obvious, you know, I guess it's a cheer moment. It's Tony Todd.
My audience has cheered both times on that.
Yeah, it's Tony Todd. Why wouldn't you be happy to see him?
It was too little too late for me. I wanted more Tony or less Tony.
Yeah, either give us all or none.
Yeah.
Tony Todd is not that special to me. He didn't need to be in this movie. He has three movies if you want to see Tony Todd do Candyman. This should have been setting up the new Candyman. Now I don't even know what a sequel would look like or who it would be involved.
I do agree that if Tony Todd never showed up in this, it wouldn't have been a problem.
No.
Right.
But you know what? To me, it would have been a problem because this is tying so much to the first Candyman film. And now we have this Sherman Candyman guy. And I was wondering why it was always Sherman and never Daniel. And now that we have Daniel back, I just take it as, you know, he's eternal. He's a He is the whisper. He is the myth, and that's going to take on many faces over time. And I think what it's saying is all Candymen are Daniel Robitaille throughout the years. And so I went with it as metaphor. I like seeing Tony Todd in this. And listen, just to make a direct comparative, it's a lot better than Bruce Campbell showing up in that Evil Dead remake. That had no integration. At least here, this has all been about the legacy of Daniel Robitaille.
Yes, and tying that legacy with a legacy of lynching and violence against black people that sacrifices coherence in order to achieve that symbolism.
So how much was sacrificed? Jacob, Stuart, is there enough sweet in Candyman for you to recommend it? Jacob.
This was a frustrating experience, and I haven't been this frustrated, I think, with a horror film since another remake that we reviewed, Suspiria. Like, that one, I'm like, oh, I didn't do the history lesson I was supposed to understand this film. Like, I don't know if this is good or not. Like, that's kind of how I felt about this one. Like, a lot of stuff about the art world, just like Suspiria, which I like. Like, all that stuff could be fascinating, but I just don't think they figured out how to get this recipe right with Candyman. Like, not enough sweet, maybe, in this one. It's hard to tell because I don't want to blame Nia DaCosta's directing. I think what we do see of her direction here is really good with the acting, with the shots, the way she composes them. Like, whoever editing, whoever was making those decisions, or the studio execs making decisions, someone turned this into a pretty incomprehensible film for me, where again, frustration is the word I'm going to use, because there's a lot of stuff I liked. I talked about the acting, the compositions, all that. Some of the kills are a lot. Again, that bathroom scene, it's a great scene, does not belong in this film. Take it out. And part of my frustration is, again, because of the pedigree, because of Jordan Peele being associated with this film, they had some great trailers. Like, I thought they were going to be able to address and fix those things from the first one that didn't quite make sense. And they just created a whole new set of problems, like, where I still don't understand this mythology. I still don't understand this killer. And Yahya's good, but he's no Tony Todd when he's Candyman. And, like, Tony Todd, give me an incomprehensible film, but Tony Todd is Candyman? Like, he was great in that first one. Like, I could just go with that because he had such a presence. And I don't think Candyman has much of a presence in this film that has the title Candyman. So it's frustrating because there is good things here, and maybe there will be a director's cut that comes out someday that could fix this film. But as it stands, I don't think fans, and again, what do I know about horror, but I would find this a frustrating experience if I was a fan of the original Candyman. I just don't think there's enough of what you'd want here. And again, I like all the intellectual stuff, all the discussions about art and racism and all that stuff they try to get into, but I don't think it makes a coherent, entertaining film, especially the third act, which just completely confused and lost me. That's where my decision comes from, is by the ending, I should understand what's going on. Oh, this is baby Anthony from the first one? That's great. Let's see where this goes. And I don't know where it goes by the end. So again, maybe this will change if we get a director's cut where we get those scenes thrown back in and it makes sense. But I'm going with a weak not recommend, just because that third act is so incomprehensible and I don't know what this movie is supposed to mean after it.
Stuart.
You know, the Suspiria remake, I think, is a good comparative, because I agree with you. That was a movie I liked too, but not giving you what you thought you came for. And yeah, it's hard not to walk away disappointed by Candyman 2021. My hope was that Oscar winner Jordan Peele, you know, he won a statue for screenwriting. He's got this new director, Nia DaCosta. Your job is to clarify what didn't make sense about that original. And I feel like they made it even more confusing. I feel like they could not decide whether they wanted to make a slasher movie where, yeah, virgins would say the name and we would have those sexualized kills like we did in the original, or whether it was just a Black Lives Matter vigilante, which I think is where they're comfortable landing the movie. But just that means that nothing that happened before makes a whole lot of sense. You know, "Be My Victim" is his tagline. I don't know who that is. And I don't know whether he's supposed to be a monster or a hero at this point. I really don't get a bead on Yahya at all. And throwing Tony Todd back in there at the end, I know it ain't Tony Todd. They should have created a new Candyman for a new generation. And instead, what we got here is kind of like when you throw in too many candies into the blizzard and it all just tastes like sugar. That's what we got. too much messing around in the post-production, too many things cut out. Those are my complaints. But I do feel like, in the end, I had a good time with this movie. Despite all of what you've just heard about not being satisfied with the narrative, that remains. I do feel like almost every scene in this movie is enjoyable. All the characters are well acted. Troy, the New York art dealer, Brianna, like, they don't have much purpose in this movie, but they're fun to watch. And yeah, I can only hope that there would be some restored director's cut where we would understand how Brianna's father played into some kind of catharsis when she finally says the name into the mirror. Like, I feel like there are so many things that should be meaningful in this movie that just don't pan out. But well shot, well directed, well acted, great production design. There's just a thrill as an ex-Chicagoan to seeing Cabrini now, how it looks and feels in its gentrification. I had a good enough time to mildly recommend this movie, but it is not Get Out. It is not Us. It is not up to the Jordan Peele standard. And I do think you're right, Jacob. People are going to be disappointed, but maybe not too disappointed. It's a good enough place to start. God knows the first movie was illogical, and I recommended that. So I'm going to recommend Green Arrow for Candyman 2021.
I'm also going to give it a recommend. When I saw it the first time, I walked out and I'm like, well, it kind of fell apart at the end, but I had really liked this film up until that point. And I agree with all of your statements, Stuart. And it reminded me, though, a lot of the first film. The first film, Bernard Rose, did not phone it in. I thought that was a gorgeous looking film. I loved its use of graffiti. I loved its social commentary. I thought it was a step above your average slasher film. It went far above Hellraiser as far as its exploration of human themes, even though Hellraiser gave us the more iconic killer. And here, for the first hour of this movie, I'm thinking it's doing the same thing. It's really artistic, it's well shot, it's doing inventive kills, even if that kill of the art critic may not satisfy the gore hounds. I thought it was really nice as a different way to depict a kill. I liked that it was continuing the first film. I liked that we had Virginia Madsen voice. I liked that we had Vanessa Williams and Tony Todd was coming back. I knew he was going to be in there somewhere. But man, Williams' plot at the end, it was just, it was very frustrating on the first viewing. Then on the second viewing, I liked it a lot less. And that's because I was realizing how many things never came up again. When you watch a movie a second time and you see things like, hey, that father jumped out of the window. We never mentioned that again. Hey, Brianna, was she in New York for that interview? She was told to go to New York. Wait, is she back in Chicago now? What art gallery is she in? Whatever happened to the brother lover? Where'd he go? Its flaws become really apparent in the third act, in what it doesn't do as much as what it does do. And the first time I saw it, it was all about what it did do. And then the second time, it was all about what it didn't do.
Yeah, I think that's correct. It's like, I have no problem with what they showed me. I have a problem with what they didn't show me.
And then having this conversation with you guys, it really reinforced all the problems. So the more I think about this film, the less I like it. So I better just give it a recommend and run out the door.
Yeah, do you still recommend it after two viewings?
If you keep talking another 5 minutes, it's going to be a strong not recommend, I think.
But I do think that there's a lot of artistry here. The one thing I felt with this film is like they weren't trying to launch a franchise. Like they, maybe Universal always has it in their mind, but I didn't feel like Blum and DaCosta were really wanting to go to Candyman 2 territory. I wonder if they will, though, because this thing really broke box office expectations. Now, who's to say what money is in a box office during a pandemic? But $25 million opening for a $25 million horror film, people have to be smiling.
Breaking even, yeah, your first week is good.
Yeah, I agree. They should be very satisfied with that, and somebody is going to want more. Whether they'll get Jordan Peele and Nia DaCosta back, I tend to think not. I agree with you. It felt like a capper. It felt like we're going to bring this thing back just to make a point, and then we're done. And if somebody else is going to pick up on this, again, who, you know, be my victim. Who's it going to be? Is it just going to literally be Candyman going around killing people that oppress urban environments? That's not scary. That is a different genre than slasher.
It is. I bet if they do another one, Peele is still listed as a producer because this is his production house. I think he'd want the paycheck. I think he'd want a little bit of input, and I think he'd want to make sure that it sticks to some messages and doesn't go to New Orleans again. But I don't think he'd be listed as a writer. I don't think he'll be that involved.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, he'll farm it out to other people.
But I agree with you, Jacob. The thing I want most is a director's cut of this movie put out on video where it would be very, very different. It would, I think.
Yeah, I feel like I need that to even judge this film because this is an incomplete film.
We did not get to see the whole movie. At least half an hour is missing.
And it's not because of COVID, because this movie was ready to come out. And as far as everything I've read, they didn't change it due to the delay.
Right.
And they didn't change it due to all the riots and everything else. Nobody's talked about changing a frame of this film since it was supposed to come out in 2020. So something else is going on. And the home video market isn't what it used to be. I'm not going to hold my breath for a director's cut of this on video, but maybe in a year or two, since it did make money, maybe they'll think, if they do a sequel, putting a better version out, you know, Nia DaCosta's Candyman, like Zack Snyder's Justice League.
That's a cut I'm more interested in than Zack Snyder's Justice League.
I do have one last question. What the hell were the shadow puppets in the end credits telling us?
The story of all the Candymen, I think.
Yeah, they definitely show you, you know, it was something that William just mentions in the laundromat that in the 1920s, there was this lynching. And then in the 1950s, there was this attack. It was actually seeing those. We saw a black store owner who was trying to sell cotton to a white man and get killed. We saw a young, looked like a child, get put in the electric chair. I'm wondering even if there aren't some historical precedents for this, that if there aren't like Emmett Till kind of stuff where we're trying to get the word out. We want people to be able to say the name of Breonna Taylor as much as Candyman. And so they're trying to use these moments to promote real tragedies and atrocities and lynchings that, if you stayed till the end, they did have a website you could go to and learn the true story of all of it.
What it said was, if you want to find more information about racial injustice and healing, candymanmovie.net/impact.
Right. So I think that there was a social conscience in telling those stories that, again, if any of those things are rooted in truth, that is awful. And this movie has done a service by bringing it to mainstream attention.
What the page has on it, there is a official companion guide to Candyman to help audiences go deeper into the themes with an education curriculum firm that specializes in culturally responsive instruction materials.
Oh my God.
So it is an official exploration of the themes of Candyman in a 47-page PDF.
Wow. I remember, like, David Lynch had to put out a whole dictionary, a glossary of terms when Dune came out because he knew audiences weren't going to understand what was being said. Maybe a little bit of that's going on here.
Oh my God, it is. It's got, like, timelines of Candyman and history of Black Chicago.
Don't get me wrong. That stuff is all cool, but I guess I'm just not jazzed enough with this movie to want to dig deeper. It was good enough, but I can't say that I want a sequel unless they really do get that into the movie and not a 47-page PDF. Yeah, because in the end, the last shot is of the five Candymen, and then there's a lot of people standing behind them in a cotton field. So I think the idea is to think about the stories that we see turning some people into Candymen as being a history of a people.
Well, thank you, donors, for saying our name and keeping us alive to continue podcasting for as long as it took them to get Candyman out and beyond.
Right. And next week, more body horror, specifically Jennifer's body, which also does have a director's cut, and maybe that will make sense. Not a very loved movie, but someone in our listenership has paid for us to give it a reconsideration. So if you're a September patron, you're going to hear that show next Friday.
So thanks again for your support whenever you donated. Jennifer's body next week. And then after that, we return to Home Invasions with Your Next. Thank you for your support. It was for you, our listeners. It was always for you.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Sweet to the sweet.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
I have a curriculum I have to follow here.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I can't say nothing, or Candyman'll get me.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Hands up, people! Fire more! Come out the back door! Police!
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Why do you want to live? If you would learn just a little from me, you would not beg to live.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of, and may not be used without the expressed written permission of, Venganza Media Incorporated.
What do the good know, except what the bad teach them by their excesses?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2021, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Our names will be written on 1,000 walls, our crimes told and retold by our faithful believers. We shall die together in front of their very eyes and give them something to be haunted by. Come with me and be immortal.
You know, the fates laughed at me. I was driving to see Candyman, and I plugged in my phone, and it was just playing random movie scores. And I'm listening to one, I'm like, this is really good. I can't place this movie. What movie is this? Jupiter Ascending? Shit!
Even weirder, because I know you hate that composer, usually.
Yeah, I do. Really do.
Maybe we need to reevaluate. I'm not ready yet, but maybe by Matrix 4, I will be.
CandymanMovie.net/